Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince. The Infinite Monkey Cage is back and we are starting the series with a whole show about trees with Dame Judi Dench. What else we got, Brian?
We're going to do What a Gas with Mark Miodovnik. Unexpected Science History with Rufus Hound. I don't know what he knows about unexpected science history.
Well, that's the unexpected thing. He hasn't got a clue.
No, I'm hoping we're having some experts on there. Exploring with Annika Rice.
No, that's just one of your dreams. The other night I dreamt I was exploring with Annika Rice. And also Alien Life in Glastonbury with Chris Lintott.
Yeah.
Infinite Monkey Cage.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 13th of July, these are our main stories. President Biden has spoken at a campaign event in Michigan to try to shore up support as more Democrats urge him to abandon his bid for re-election because of concerns about his age. Officials in central Nigeria say at least 16 people have been killed when a two-story school building collapsed. Kenya's president has replaced his police chief after officers shot dead dozens of people protesting against tax hike plans last month. The BBC has been told that the Gaza ceasefire negotiations being held in Qatar and Egypt have ended without success. Also in this podcast, another way people are fighting for Ukraine.
Instead of holding up a weapon, I held up my baton and decided I could fight on the cultural front.
The Freedom Orchestra, which has begun a European tour. President Biden flew to the US state of Michigan on Friday as he attempts to steady the nerves of fellow Democrats and votes who are increasingly concerned about his re-election campaign. Hours earlier, the leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives, Hakeem Jeffries, met the president to discuss his colleagues' worries. He's reported to have bluntly shared their views. Nearly 20 congressional Democrats have now publicly urged Mr. Biden to withdraw after his poor TV debate performance last month with Donald Trump. Then, on Thursday at a NATO summit, Mr. Biden made two high-profile gaffes at his first unscripted news conference for 8 months. So, it was against this background that the US president addressed a Friday evening campaign rally in Detroit.
Folks, you probably noticed there's a lot of speculation lately. What's Joe Biden going to do? Is he going to stay in the race? Is he going to drop out? Here's my answer. I am running, and we're going to win. I'm not going to change that. I'm the nominee of the Democratic Party, the only Democrat or Republican who has beaten Donald Trump ever. And I'm going to beat him again. I know him. Donald Trump is a loser.
Mr. Biden also had this to say.
When that butcher, Putin, who I know and have known for a long time, when he invaded Ukraine, here's what Trump said. I'm not making this up either. He called him a genius and said it was wonderful. What in the hell is going on? But people would rather talk about how I mix up names. I guess they don't remember that Trump called Nikki Haley Nancy Pelosi. Well, no. No more. Donald, no more free passes.
One of Donald Trump's biggest Republican supporters, Vivek Ramaswamy, has told the BBC's World Business Report that it is unlikely that President Biden will be the person Donald Trump faces in November. Rahul Tandon spoke to Mr. Ramaswamy, a former candidate in the 2020 US presidential election, and began by asking him for his views on President Biden's recent media gaffes.
Well, look, I think it's a matter of the standards that you set. I expect higher standards of a U.S. commander in chief, not to refer to President Zelensky as Mr. Putin, which I thought was beneath the U.S. presidency. Same thing referring to his opponent in the presidential election as Vice President Trump. Yes, those are gaffes, those are verbal slip-ups. But the fact that we're applying a standard so low to the U.S. presidency itself, I think shows how far our own standards have fallen. And the reality is President Biden has not effectively been really the president of the United States in any meaningful sense. He is a figurehead for the managerial class that's actually running the show beneath him. And I think that's the deeper problem, not just in the United States, but across much of the modern West and Western democracies.
Do you think that he will be the Democratic nominee come November?
I think it's unlikely.
Who will be the Democratic nominee?
Look, that's an open question. In the modern United States, the Democratic Party has a fixation on identity politics, the politics of race, gender, and sexuality. As a consequence, Biden got himself what you could think of as, in the corporate context, you would call a poison pill with Kamala Harris as the vice president. She was somebody who was wildly unpopular. In the Democratic primary, she didn't even make it to the Iowa caucus. Yet she got selected as the vice president, patently because of, foremost, her race and gender. She's a black woman. So the reality is, if that was the reason for choosing her, that's now an albatross. They can't pass over her for those attributes unless they go with somebody else who has those same attributes. So pragmatically, I believe there's two viable choices for who could succeed Biden this year. It's either Kamala Harris or it's Michelle Obama. And it'll come down to how much the Democrats are willing to really force themselves to put the best candidate forward versus putting just another candidate to Biden forward. And that's going to play out, I believe, in the next couple of months between now and the Democratic convention in late August.
I'm sure many people would disagree with that in terms of identity politics being the reason that Kamala Harris was chosen. This is a very fiercely contested election.
Look, you may be pushing back on me because I think many Republicans are, I think, too complacent right now. I am a bit of a minority voice in the Republican Party saying that complacency is not an option. A lot of people in the Republican camp appear to be celebrating like this election is over. I believe this election has not even yet gotten started until the Democrats really put up their actual nominee. So is this a foregone conclusion that one side or the other is going to win? Far from it. I think this is going to be deeply contested until the very end.
Vivek Ramaswamy. The BBC has been told that the mediated Gaza ceasefire negotiations being held in Qatar and Egypt have ended without success. It's hoped further talks will take place in future. Contacts between the mediators and both Israel and Hamas are due to continue. Here's the BBC's Rushdie Abu Alouf.
Hamas official told the BBC that they accuse the Israeli Prime Minister, Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu, of sabotaging the ceasefire talks. They said it's for his own interest. He doesn't want this deal to go ahead. We haven't heard back from the Israelis yet, but this is what Hamas are accusing Israel of. This news was very sad and very frustrating for about 2.3 million people in Gaza who are suffering for the last 9 months from this war, and they were hoping that an agreement could put an end for the war, but not this time.
Rushdie Abu Alouf there. Well, the statement in the Gaza ceasefire talks comes as the war rages on and the number of casualties continues to rise. The Hamas-run civil defence agency in Gaza said it found around 60 bodies after Israeli troops withdrew from parts of Gaza City on Friday. More than 38,000 people have been killed and tens of thousands more wounded since the war began last October. That's according to the Hamas-run health ministry. Fergal Keane reports now on the families in Gaza caught up in the violence, from Shujaya, scene of fierce fighting in recent days, to Khan Yunis in the south.
An Israeli soldier looks down the crosshairs of his weapon and fires. Beyond the window, the glare of the sun, the dust raised by constant explosions, the heat bearing down on all who live in Gaza and on the swelling corpses of the dead. This is Shujaya, north of Gaza City, and scene of some of the hardest house-to-house fighting in recent days. Israel is back fighting in a place that was supposed to have been cleared of Hamas. This is the sound of Hamas attacking an Israeli tank farther south. After 9 months of war, there's devastation across vast swathes of the Gaza Strip. Shujaya is the latest neighbourhood to see streets pulverised, houses toppled, and its people forced to flee for their lives. Sharif Abu Shanab has witnessed the destruction of his home.
We have been thrown in the streets. We have no home or anything. Where do we go? There is only one solution, and that is to hit us with a nuclear bomb and relieve us of this life.
The civil defence rescuers are working in bombed areas from Gaza City in the north to Rafah in the south. In the last few days, much of their time has been spent collecting bodies. They move quickly as they fear attack by Israeli forces. They stop in a street where a body lies next to a shop doorway. There's another about 100 yards farther on. Later, they lower a girl's body from the second floor of a building. Mohammed Al-Maghayr is a local civil defence official.
It is very difficult to identify the bodies of the martyrs. Some remain unidentified because they have decomposed. The clothes they were wearing were also destroyed by stray animals eating the bodies, making it challenging to determine their identities.
Back in the north, refugees are leaving Gaza City to try and find safety in central Gaza. This is the sound of a joyous reunion. The women of the Al-Fayoumi family embrace. In the boiling heat, the new arrivals are handed bottles of water. A girl hugs her aunt, beaming with joy. Then she turns her head and begins to cry. Coming up the road were two teenage boys, cousins. They'd fled alone and said they were shot at by the Israelis on the way.
The explosions, the gunfire and the bombs were too much. I left my mother there. Who stayed behind? My mother, my sisters and my father, who was martyred. God rest his soul.
That report was by Fergal Keane. At least 16 people were killed and many more injured when a two-storey building housing a school collapsed on Friday morning in Nigeria's central Plateau state. A massive search and rescue operation is underway to find students and teachers who are still trapped in the rubble. Our correspondent Chris Awoko gave Chris Barrow this update from Abuja.
The situation in Nigeria now is that of shock because of the magnitude of the disaster that happened with the collapsing of the two-story building housing a school. And we're told that the school hosts hundreds of students. They were writing the exams early in the morning, and these children were in their classes when suddenly the building caved in, falling upon the children and their teachers. Many were trapped, some died, and there had been excavation of the rubble, the concrete and the twisted rods to try to remove those trapped. Many were injured, rushed to hospitals, and there have been calls by medics for a blood donation to help save the lives of those who were seriously injured and had lost blood.
Do we have any idea at this stage of what could have caused the collapse? And is there a history of buildings collapsing?
Nigeria has a history of building collapse, actually. Over a long time, there have been collapse of buildings, especially in Lagos, southwest Nigeria, even here in Abuja. And in most cases, they are blamed on the use of substandard materials, as well as lack of adherence to the proper regulations for putting up structures in Nigeria. And it's caused a loss of lives. It's cost money. And in this case, people are also suggesting that the school building collapse could be as a result of either a defect in the structure or use of substandard materials. But authorities actually yet to confirm that. All attention now focused on how to save the lives of those injured and console the parents of those who lost their children. The Nigerian President Bola Ahmed Tinubu has sent condolence messages to the parents who lost their children as well as those who are injured. And the governor of Plateau State, central Nigeria, has also consoled the families. But many Nigerians are expecting to see what action this tragedy could move the government to take regarding how to address the incessant incidents of building collapse in the country.
Chris Awoko. Now to a group of musicians brought together by conflict 2 years ago as the Ukrainian Freedom Orchestra starts their summer tour in Paris. It was formed in response to the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine and will now play in some of the great cathedrals and concert halls of Europe and the United States. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
Playing together, surrounded by rubble, an orchestra gathered on the ruins of a children's hospital in Kyiv, bringing moments of peace to a site decimated by war. It's typical of the spirit of the musicians of Ukraine, who've refused to stop playing despite constant bombardment.
Instead of holding up a weapon, I held up my baton and decided I could fight on the cultural front.
Kerry Lynn Wilson, who's of Ukrainian descent, is the creator of the Ukrainian Freedom Orchestra. It's been playing since the start of the conflict, and as Ukrainians fight for the freedom of their country on the battlefield, Kerry Lynn sees music as another type of resistance. The group's world tour is opening with a piece dedicated to the Bucha massacre, which was uncovered in the first few months of the invasion and which Kerry Lynn had first-hand experience of.
I also visited Bucha and was absolutely horrified. So I decided that this work, Bucha Lacrimos, it's a beautiful piece because not only does it have these, the emotion of pain, which I really want audiences to hear, but there's a message of hope in it. It ends with these beautiful rising arpeggios in the solo violin. It's a symbol of the eternal power of good.
The musicians are mostly refugees or have special permission to be away. But while they may be away from home while touring, home is never far away for them.
Sometimes because of tears, I can play normally because you're checking the news from the mobile phones and you're trying to play and you see the signs, you see the notes, the some words, but your mind is still with those pictures from Kyiv and you can't stop tears.
One of the messages the orchestra wants to get across is that of awareness, reminding the international community that Ukraine needs their help and reminding Ukrainians that help is coming.
It's a message of power, of beauty and good over evil. And that's really what our orchestra is. And it's a message that the Ukrainian spirit won't die.
Stephanie Prentice reporting on the Ukrainian Freedom Orchestra. Still to come.
We usually are very reluctant to diagnose people with narcissistic personality disorder prior to age 21, because in adolescence, we consider narcissism to be a very good thing.
In adulthood, not.
In adulthood, it's dysfunctional.
Well, now new research suggests that narcissistic people actually get more agreeable with age.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince. The Infinite Monkey Cage is back and we are starting the series with a whole show about trees with Dame Judi Dench. What else we got, Brian?
We're going to do What a Gas with Mark Miodovnik. Unexpected Science History with Rufus Hound. I don't know what he knows about unexpected science history.
Well, that's unexpected thing. He hasn't got a clue.
No, I'm hoping we're having some experts on there. Exploring with Annika Rice.
No, that's just one of your dreams. The other night I dreamt I was exploring with Annika Rice. And also Alien Life in Glastonbury with Chris Lintott.
Yeah.
Infinite Monkey Cage.
Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
146 nations around the world are signatories to the Refugee Convention, and that means they have to allow people who are in fear of their lives or other persecution to claim asylum. Now, Finland signed that convention, but it's just adopted a new law which would allow officials to turn away asylum seekers. It follows a surge of people arriving on Finland's eastern border. Helsinki's accused Russia of instrumentalising migration, that's deliberately using refugees for political gain. Nevertheless, the UNHCR regional representative for the Nordics and Baltics, Annika Sundlund, is worried about this new law.
The idea behind it is really to combat instrumentalization and sort of send a signal to Russia. And many of the Finnish politicians have been very clear on saying that this is the aim of the bill, is to send a signal to use, again, refugees and migrants in a sort of game. And the concern from our side is that it allows for the denial of access to territory and asylum, which is one of the sort of fundamental principles of refugee law.
Our Europe regional editor, Charles Haviland, tell me more about the implications of this new law.
What it means is that for a period of a year to start with, in certain parts of the border guards will have the discretion to turn people back, asylum seekers arriving from Russia, whether they be Russian nationals or nationals of other countries such as Syria and Somalia are two that have been mentioned. In contrast to what the UN agencies are saying, the Finnish government is saying that this will apply in scenarios where there is a threat to the national security of Finland. It says that whether you like it or not, it as a government is looking after the security of the country and that of the European Union, because the Finnish border with Russia, more than 1,300 kilometres, is the longest national border of any EU country with Russia.
And that's how they get around the fact that they're signatories to the Refugee Convention, so they're obliged to hear asylum claims, but they're saying, because of national security, this law trumps that.
Yeah, it's not to say that there hasn't been opposition within Finland. It is being dubbed deportation law by its opponents, and one parliamentarian, an opposition parliamentarian, said after the adoption of this law by Parliament that it's a sad day for Finnish rule of law and human rights, and she accused the government of acting in violation of its own stated understanding that the law does run contrary to both EU law and international human rights law.
And part of the government's claim that this is about national security refers to instrumentalising migration on the part of Russia. What do they mean by that?
What I think they mean is that they accuse Russia of deliberately, if you like, encouraging them to cross into Finland, saying that this has particularly become an issue after Finland joined NATO, much to Moscow's dismay, which was in 2023 and was a direct result, as far as we can tell, of the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, interestingly enough, Russia's closest ally, Belarus, was accused of the same before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, back in about 2021. It was accused by governments of its border countries, such as Poland and Lithuania, of bringing people to the border and literally trying to push them across the border. Now, Moscow denies that there is any such instrumentalisation policy and has been very critical of recent Finnish moves to tighten up the border controls.
Charles Haviland. China claims huge areas of the South China Sea as its own territorial waters. It's not afraid to use its full military and diplomatic heft to enforce that. And in recent months, that has brought it into conflict with the Philippines. Beijing is demanding now that Manila withdraws its coast guard in that area called the Sabina Shoal. Manila says it won't back down. Our Asia-Pacific regional editor, Mickey Bristow, told me more.
There's been several confrontations between the Philippines and China in the South China Sea over the last year. We've had confrontations in the Scarborough Shoal, the Second Thomas Shoal. Now we've opened up what looks like a fresh front at the Sabina Shoal, an area in the South China Sea in the Spratly Islands. Earlier this year, the Philippines claimed that China had been damaging coral reef at the shoal, and they think that was the way to prepare the ground in order to build an artificial island. So what the Philippines has done since April, it's stationed at least one large Coast Guard vessel at Sabina Shoal, and that's been there permanently. What's happened today is China said, look, leave the area. We've got sovereignty over the area. So it looks like this is another part of the South China Sea, which could lead to conflict between China and the Philippines.
So you say that China is claiming sovereignty over that area, but it's much closer to the Philippines than it is to China. What's the legality of Beijing's claim?
Like many of the islands China claims in the South China Sea, they're closer to other countries than they are to the Chinese mainland. So in this particular case, we have an international court ruling, the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which ruled actually 8 years ago to this day. It's the eighth anniversary. And it said China's claims in the South China Sea, famously contained within a nine-dash line, were essentially just not valid at all. So China, according to the International Court, has no claims to this particular area in the South China Sea. China rejects that court ruling. In fact, today on this anniversary, it said that ruling was a political farce dressed up in legal garb. So that's what China thinks about it. But certainly, as far as international law is concerned, that's on the side of the Philippines.
So, Mickey, how dangerous is this current standoff?
There is real potential for this to be a flashpoint. This situation could escalate. Both sides have chosen not to do so, but that could happen. Also, the Philippines has military alliances with the United States. Most importantly, they could also be drawn into this. So it's a really dangerous situation which hasn't turned into anything too serious yet, but that's the potential.
Mickey Bristow. New research suggests that narcissistic people get more agreeable with age. Well, the findings into the personality trait, seen since the 1980s as a medically diagnosable disorder, is published by the journal Psychological Bulletin. It is based on data from 51 existing studies, and it indicates that people who have an unshakable belief that they're better or more deserving than others are likely to mellow the older they get. Paul Henley spoke to Sam Vaknin, an author and professor of clinical psychology at the Commonwealth Institute of Advanced and Professional Studies. He describes himself on a social media account as a self-admitted diagnosed narcissist, and he takes issue with quite a lot of the research.
Methodological problem with all these studies, previous and current, is that they actually don't deal with narcissism. They don't deal with people who have been diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. The vast majority of these studies deal with people who are possessed of what is known as a narcissistic style, or, in the more extreme case, people with a dark triad personality. Now, this is a bit like the relationship between the common cold and life-threatening pneumonia. And most of these studies are unable to secure the participation and the collaboration of people with narcissistic personality disorder because antagonism is one of the main features of narcissists. And so they never collaborate well, especially not in studies.
And you believe that narcissistic traits in childhood can actually be a positive attribute, don't you?
Narcissism in childhood and in adolescence is considered to be healthy. It is the foundation of self-esteem and self-confidence and the ability to regulate one's sense of self-worth. Actually, there's no identity without narcissism. Narcissism is a kind of self-preoccupation which gradually coalesces into the formation of an identity. We usually are very reluctant to diagnose people with narcissistic personality disorder prior to age 21. Because in adolescence, we consider narcissism to be a very good thing.
In adulthood, not.
In adulthood, it's dysfunctional. It holds you back. Narcissists have a series of 9 problems. Number 1, they lack empathy. Number 2, they fear intimacy and are incapable of dealing with it. Number 3, they have identity problems. They don't know exactly who they are. Number 4, they are antagonistic. They're conflict-prone and envious. Number 5, they seek attention. They use attention to regulate their own sense of self-esteem and self-confidence and self-worth. Number 6, they're grandiose. They have an inflated, fantastic self-perception and self-image. Number 7, they're dissocial. They're antisocial. In other words, they're a bit psychopathic. They're a bit on the border between legal and illegal, legitimate and illegitimate behavior. Number 8, they are obsessive-compulsive. And number 9, they have what is known as negative affects. In other words, they are besieged and consumed by negative emotions, such as anger, rage, envy, hatred, and so on.
And do you recognize anything in this claim that the severity of these conditions eases with age?
There are rigorous studies that support the claim that antagonism in narcissism ameliorates with age, and not only in narcissism, also in psychopathy, and also in borderline personality disorder. The tendency to conflict with people, the tendency to abuse them and to attack them, to undermine them aggressively or passive-aggressively, to externalize aggression and to express it, and to render it a kind of ideological spine. I'm aggressive, therefore I'm superior. I'm aggressive, therefore I'm wonderful. This ameliorates with age, and not only in narcissism. And we think that's something to do with biology. Or with genetics. We think there's a hereditary component, definitely in psychopathy and borderline. And we increasingly believe that narcissism does have a hereditary component and that antagonism is a psychobiological or psychosociobiological issue. In other words, it's something to do with the body or the brain as well as the behavior. However, there is no support for any other claim. For example, there's absolutely no support for the claim made in the meta study that empathy increases among narcissists with the lifespan.
Sam Vaknin, author and professor of clinical psychology. Now, they're one of the most recognisable sites in Britain, the famous red post boxes. Now, the first one to carry King Charles's cipher, a kind of stylized initials, has been unveiled in southern England. Post boxes have a long-standing tradition, first appearing in Queen Victoria's reign in 1852. Claire Runacres has this report.
As the King's representative in the County of Cambridgeshire, it gives me great pleasure to unveil the first postbox of the Carolean era.
A crowd of people gathered to see the first monogrammed postbox in the Cambridgeshire village of Great Camborne. Marked out in gold are the overlapping initials CR for Charles Rex. Inside the R, the Roman numerals for 3, all under a Tudor crown. It's just over 170 years since the writer Anthony Trollope, who was working for the post office, suggested the use of postboxes. The first had Queen Victoria's cipher on them. They were hexagonal and painted dark green. The ciphers have stayed, but their colour changed quite quickly to a more distinctive red. Many are still in use today, as Chris Taff from the Post Office Museum explains.
They're not replaced when a new monarch comes to the throne, new boxes are introduced. So this is the first that we see of Charles III, but you can still walk the streets and see boxes from every monarch.
The first letter posted today was fittingly addressed to the King and was from local schoolchildren. Robert said they had a shared passion.
In my letter I asked the King whether he has any tips about taking care of the environment.
The King cipher will now be applied to the doors of Royal Mail's fleet of vehicles. The first 100 setting out today, with many more in the weeks to come.
That report by Claire Runacres. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randall. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
Hello, I'm Brian Cox.
I'm Robin Ince. The Infinite Monkey Cage is back and we are starting the series with a whole show about trees with Dame Judi Dench. What else have we got, Brian?
We're going to do What a Gas with Mark Miodovnik. Unexpected Science History with Rufus Hound. I don't know what he knows about unexpected science history.
Well, that's the unexpected thing. He hasn't got a clue.
No, I'm hoping we're having some experts on there. Exploring with Annika Rice.
No, that's just one of your dreams. The other night I dreamt I was exploring with Annika Rice. And also Alien Life in Glastonbury with Chris Lintott.
Yeah.
Infinite Monkey Cage.
Listen, wherever you get your podcasts.